Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Theory of Enchantment podcast. I'm your host, Chloe Valdery. This week I sit down with Arno Michaelis, a former white nationalist who is now a public speaker, an author, and a teacher who talks about love, healing, and the power of connection to counter violent extremism in the world. This is one of my favorite episodes, all-time favorite episodes. So if you listen to no other episode on the Theory of Enchantment podcast, be sure to listen to this one because it's pretty amazing. And as always, I, of course, appreciate your sharing, likes, retweets on social media, and general sharing with your friends and family. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy this episode. I'm speaking right now with Arno Michaelis.
Yes, perfect.
And you know what? I'll let you describe yourself. What would you say is your bio? You know, how would you describe yourself?
Well, my bio is I'm a speaker, I'm an author, I'm an educator, and I'm a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And all of those things are kind of informed and in the context of my past as a former neo-Nazi skinhead. Mm-hmm.
So let's dive right into that. Tell us about that. Tell us your story. Tell us about your life.
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was pretty well-to-do, mm-hmm. predominantly white, very conservative. Mm-hmm. By the standards of my neighborhood, like, I was the poor kid. Mm-hmm. But by global standards, our family was ridiculously wealthy.
Sure.
Nice house, nice neighborhood. I never went hungry, never took a beating. My parents were together. They both loved me very much. Mm-hmm. They let me know that all the time. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all the adults in my life were, like, constantly fawning over me. I was so wonderful and gifted and what a genius, and he can do anything.
Right.
And this is all, like, Monday morning psychoanalysis, like, looking back and trying to see where things went wrong and
sure.
trying to put my finger on it.
Do you think it would have been better if they would have been more harsh on you?
That gets brought up a lot.
Okay.
Like, a lot of people are like, you just needed a good ass whooping.
Yeah.
That's like...
yeah.
I can't necessarily dispute that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was then and I remain like a person who, if I'm told I can't do something or mm-hmm. I have to do something, mm-hmm. that'll guarantee I'm not going to do it.
Okay.
Or I will do it or I'm not going to do it accordingly.
Okay.
And so, had my parents been more strict with me, it could have went even more wrong.
Okay.
But it could have sorted it out, too.
Right.
Like, I can't say either way.
Right.
But it was funny because my parents, like, I was such a crazy kid. Mm-hmm. My parents have this, like, urban mythology about my childhood.
Okay.
My dad is a wonderful storyteller. Mm-hmm. He gets real into hyperbole sometimes.
Okay.
But he'll be like, yeah, when Arnie was 6 months old, we found him 80 feet up in a tree in the backyard. And I was probably like 2 and 10 feet up in the tree.
But right. Right.
It was that combined with like all other crazy. I was like constantly bolting.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I could walk, I'd bolt out of the house and just go down mm-hmm. the road. And then they'd lock the door, and I'd figure out how to unlock it. Mm-hmm. And then they'd put a hook way at the top of the door, and I'd build a teetering mound of high chair phone books to scale, and then pop the hook, and then bolt.
Very resourceful.
I was, and I was always, like, had to be in constant motion.
Yeah.
And then my parents took me to the doctor, and they're like, what the hell's wrong with this kid?
Yeah.
And the doctor said, oh, there's nothing wrong with him. He's just such a genius.
The doctor said this
yeah,
also.
Yeah, surprisingly. And tragically, many kids of that nature today mm-hmm. are, like, medicated into oblivion.
Right. Meaning they don't receive that same feedback.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't get that leeway.
Right.
And instead, they typically get medicine that
right.
just, like...
calms them down.
Yeah, zombies them out.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of how I grew up, and everything was pretty idyllic, but... My father's an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and his drinking put a lot of pressure on my mom mm-hmm. to had to work 2 jobs sometimes to keep the lights on and the bills paid in our nice house in a nice neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And their relationship sucked. Mm-hmm. My mom was constantly miserable, constantly stressed. And as much as she tried to hide it and always put a happy face on for us, which she did, mm-hmm. You can tell when you're a kid that your mom's hurting. And rather than be a good kid and be like, hey, mom, I'm sorry you're hurting. What can I do to help you? I love you.
Right.
I just started lashing out at other kids.
Okay.
So I was a bully on the school bus as early as kindergarten. And I started to get, like, stimulation from causing havoc at school.
Wow, okay.
It became, like, an addiction. And just like when you're addicted to heroin or mm-hmm. alcohol or cocaine or whatever, like, what gets you off the first time, mm-hmm. 10 times later doesn't anymore. Right. So you have to keep escalating it.
Right.
And as I grew older, my antisocial behavior kept escalating, and I went from being a bully on a school bus to fights in the schoolyard, breaking and entering, vandalism. Started drinking when I was 14.
Wow.
First time I drank till I passed out, and I drank like that for another 20 years. And then by the time I'm 16, I'm like a full-blown alcoholic.
Were you afraid the first time you passed out? I mean, did it freak you out?
No. No, it was actually like, I don't remember being scared, but looking back, it's scary to think about like how comfortable being drunk out of control was.
Yeah.
It was just like a genetic thing for me.
Okay.
And I, from that point forward for 20 years, like my life literally revolved around the acquisition and drinking of alcohol.
Do you think that was at all affected by your father being an alcoholic or?
Yeah. Alcoholism is a nature and nurture disease.
Okay.
It is genetic.
Okay.
I'm Arno the Fourth.
Yeah.
And all the Arnos before me were, raging drunks. And and we're getting better by generation.
Right.
Arno the Second, my grandpa literally drank himself to death.
Wow.
I don't know enough about my great-grandpa, but my dad, when he was in his, like, late 50s, he moved out to Oregon and started an insurance agency. And he didn't quit altogether, but he just kind of dialed it down.
Okay.
So he got a lot more done, and he still drinks. He has some health problems now, and I think the drinking may have stepped up a little more lately. Mm. But we're all alcoholics, but we've all been very, very functional alcoholics.
Right.
Right. I actually, there's a thing I've kind of coined. It's like the Arno curse, where your hungover, half-assed effort is like better than some people's best effort.
Right.
So that means you can easily, like, underachieve and just party your way through life.
Right.
My dad's an insurance agent. He's a certified life underwriter. He's an accountant. He's a securities license. He's incredibly smart.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really dedicated to the people he works with. And he's a great businessman. But I don't know that he's achieved anywhere near his potential.
Mm-hmm.
And the same could be said as my grandpa. And so I quit drinking when I was 34.
Okay.
And that was a huge, huge turning point in my life. And it's interesting. There is no Arno the Fifth.
Mm.
But I have a daughter who I think she was 18 when she said, like, Dad, I don't think I can drink responsibly.
Oh, wow.
And she's been, it's not easy, especially when you're 18 years old.
Right.
Like, that's a time when you should be partying and drinking, right, like, according to society. And she kind of, like, sowed those wild oats and is now at 26, like, okay, I'm not going to drink anymore.
Oh, wow. It's totally.
Exactly.
Not doing it.
Yeah. I'm super proud of her.
Yeah.
And it speaks volumes for her character.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, it's a hopeful thing to get this disease is genetic, and with every generation, each generation is doing a little better than the one
that's
ahead
good
of them. So that's huge.
Yeah, that's very promising. So you sort of descended into a, how would you call it, a phase of rage.
That's absolutely,
so to speak. And given that you just said that, you know, you grew up in a more or less loving environment, loving family environment, where do you think, if you could trace it back, or maybe it's not monocausal, maybe it's multiple causes or multiple sources, where do you think that sense of rage stemmed from or came from in the first place?
Again, I think it's definitely nature and nurture.
Okay.
A lot of this is like my personality type.
Okay.
There's a lot of there's a lot of people, a lot of kids who have much harder childhoods than I had.
Sure.
And they never go on to hurt people and hate people.
Sure.
And I never think there's an excuse for that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was researching for my first book, I literally had to like find my friends from the skinhead days who had turned around and were still willing to talk to me,
mm-hmm.
And sit down and like do hundreds of hours of interviews with them just to get like a clear picture of what happened because I was so drunk all the time.
Oh, I see.
And many of them had really, really difficult childhoods where you're like, I'm not surprised this guy turned out this way.
Right.
For me, I think it was just kind of a perfect storm. And I really think a lot of it, and this is, it's ironic because I do think affirmation is a important thing
mm-hmm.
for raising children. But I think because of all the affirmation I got
mm-hmm.
and because I was suffering, my response to it was, I'm not wonderful.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
If you don't believe how not wonderful I am, watch what I do to this kid.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Like, watch what I do to your school.
Right.
Watch what I do to your town.
Right.
And so I really kind of started to define myself as like this anti-hero.
So are you saying that the image that you saw of yourself was not the image that other people were using to describe you?
That'd be a perfect way to say it.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember in sixth grade, it occurred to me that the standardized test we took every year was like why I kept getting put in the gifted mm-hmm. genius classes. And I just wanted to be lazy. So, like, in sixth grade, I just tanked it. I played tic-tac-toe and, like, purposely.
Yeah.
And apparently I wasn't a gifted genius enough to game it because the teacher's like, yeah, we know you tanked this. And you're going to have to take it again.
Oh, they caught you. Wow.
Right. I wasn't quite that much of a genius where I could tank it without them knowing. But, I mean, that kind of, like, summarizes. I didn't want to be this golden boy.
I see.
And I think the trauma, my adverse childhood experiences, certainly has something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
It all kind of just fell into place that way.
I see. Okay. So tell us about the process because I was reading one of your books actually on the way here, the PDF form. You started out, you didn't start out in the sort of neo-Nazi scene. Like, you initially had friends from minority groups, and then you talked about how there was this incident where you were breakdancing, and then you got into a fight with a gang member, a fight with, like, the older people, the jocks or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then the people who were supposed to be a part of your crew didn't come to defend you, and then you specified. You're like, oh, those black guys didn't come over to defend me. We're supposed to be in the, and this sort of spiraled out. So can you talk a little bit about that process from which you were first just sort of aggressive to transitioning into the world of neo-Nazi skinheads?
Yeah, that incident was like a stepping stone. I don't know that it was like, okay, now I hate black people.
Right.
and it should be said, like, the whole setup to that is that in, I think it was in late sixth grade, I started breakdancing.
Okay.
And I was like one of the first white kids to really be enamored with black culture.
Yeah.
I saw Run DMC and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and like New Edition. And I was super into it. Every Saturday I'd go to a roll arena, mm-hmm. like just kind of on the fringes of the ghetto with one of my black friends, and we'd break dance all night and battle. And I felt very like urban and I'm like, this is all, 'cause I despised like the safety of my neighborhood.
Okay.
It was just so boring to me.
Unreal to you? Like, did it feel inauthentic?
Exactly. Yeah. It didn't feel authentic. Yeah. And I realized like just how privileged that that viewpoint is. Like, oh, let's go to the ghetto where it's interesting and dangerous. I mean, I didn't really like think of it that way.
Yeah.
But I really never felt more authentic than when I was at Starlight Roll Arena breakdancing.
Right.
Like battling. and listened to like Jam on It or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I during that time, I was really like opposed to racism.
Okay.
I didn't really see any racism in society. There weren't any like racist people I knew, but just the idea of it was really offensive to me.
Yeah.
And so this, I went on as this breakdancer kid and I got pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. And I like performed at the talent show with my crew. And, I was always like, everybody knew who I was.
Sure.
Half people loved me. Other people hated me.
Sure.
But like very few people had just a neutral opinion on me. And I started to get attention from girls, and I was, you know, loving that. And I'm being this, like, cool breakdancing kid who's different than everybody else.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of part of the attraction.
Sure.
And all the jock kids, didn't take kindly to that.
Right.
And it was weird because I always kind of spanned all the cliques in my school.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was a jock. I played football. I wrestled. And even when I was a little kid, like, I'd play football in the front yard with all the kids in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I was a nerd.
Right.
I was a punk rocker. I was a breakdancer.
Right.
I every little clique there was, I had a toe in it. And but this one day at recess, we're out in it's just like a big blacktop parking lot. And suddenly I just find myself surrounded by like 20, 30 of the jock kids, some of whom I had been really good friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And they jumped on me and they held me down. And back then, the cool thing for breakdancer kids was you would have kind of a short little crew cut looking haircut, but then in the back, you'd have this long little rat tail.
Okay.
And if you want to get really fresh, you'd like dip it in hydrogen peroxide. And so that's what I did. And these guys like held me down, and all of a sudden I realized they had a scissors.
Yeah.
And I'm like fighting for my life. I'm fighting for all I'm worth, but it's, you know, there's like 20 guys. I can't stop them all. And they finally end up like cutting off my rat tail. And then they all disappear laughing, and they're running around with it like a trophy.
Yeah.
And I was just absolutely like felt violated.
Yeah.
Like just, I was just destroyed and crying hysterically, and I like ran home. And at the moment, it didn't really, like, I didn't think, like, where were my guys?
Yeah.
But as I sort of just, like, digested and everything sink in, I'm like, where were my guys?
Yeah.
Like, I hung out with about a crew of about 10 people,
mm-hmm.
Which included probably all the black kids in my grade.
Yeah.
and
this is a predominantly white school.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, very, very white. A few black kids, a few Asian kids, a couple Latino kids,
mm-hmm.
a lot of Jewish kids,
mm-hmm.
but predominantly white. And I was just like, where were my guys?
Yeah.
Like, why didn't they have my back? Like, why didn't they help me?
Yeah.
And I at the moment, I didn't think of it as a racial thing. Like,
okay.
Oh, they didn't help me because they're black or whatever. But I definitely, like, we acted like we were a gang. We wanted to be a gang, actually.
Right.
We would kind of, and I was like, well, that's some gang. When, like, I get jumped and y'all just, like, disappear.
Please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a stepping stone. I think in the book Gift, it was definitely, like, a plot device.
Okay.
But, it took me a while to recover from that and just, like, emotionally and socially. And as I did, I wasn't like, well, I'm done with breakdancing. But
right.
it was the kind of thing where me always being in motion.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay, now it's time for the motion to continue. And
right.
I'm going to go do something else. I'm
going
to go through some other phase. And that kind of took me up to 14. And that's why I started getting into punk rock, and then the punk rock led to hearing the white power skinhead music.
So I don't know if this is true for today, but you're saying back then there was an overlap sort of between people who ran in the circles of punk rock and people who ran in the circles of the neo-Nazi scene, and that's how you sort of transitioned into that. So I'm just curious, who, like, what group did you meet first, or what individual did you meet first? Like, how did that exchange go down? Where someone was like, "Hey, you want to join my white power?" Like, how did it
right,
happen?
Right.
You know,
I always say in all my talks, because I still love punk.
Yeah,
and I listen to all kinds of stuff, and I think there's a lot of good things about the whole like punk rock idea, not conforming, questioning mm-hmm. authority, mm-hmm. doing things yourself. So I always say I never want to make it sound like punk is some kind of gateway drug to becoming a white sure. power skinhead.
Sure.
But if you talk to 10 former white power skinheads, I would bet my vast fortune that 7 or 8 of them had come through the punk scene, if not sure. all of them.
Sure.
So it was definitely like a channel
mm-hmm.
that would be used to reach the your pissed off white kid demographic.
Okay.
And part of being in a punk is being pissed.
Right.
Like you're angry about everything.
It's, right.
It's just like part of the deal. And to me, in the 80s, punk was just about like breaking shit.
Okay.
Like just smashing things and yeah. offending people and repulsing society and rebelling. And it was definitely like I just wanted the pure rebellion. I didn't okay. want it to be for some kind of cause.
Okay.
And
just for its own sake.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in the late 80s, and interestingly now, the bulk of it, and punk has changed so much. I think it was like into its second or third wave by the time I was into it. But nowadays, like most people you'd meet who would consider themselves some kind of punk rockers are typically like very far left activist type people.
Okay.
Who are like, you know, we're going to smash these corporations and the patriarchy and right. yada, yada, yada. There was kind of early versions of that in the late 80s. We called them peace punks.
Okay. And wait, is that like the band that you ended up joining? Because I was very intrigued by the fact that this band that you, I believe, ended up joining was initially like, no, we don't drink alcohol. We don't.
Oh, that, well, yeah, that was my first punk band I was in.
Yeah.
Was called Stolen Youth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bunch of, like, filthy, stinking rich kids from Mequon.
Yeah. That's like a scene right out of 8 Mile, by the
way. Totally, totally.
Like, in reverse. But, yeah. Different genre of music, but, yeah.
The guy whose house we practiced in his, you know, big furnished basement, and his dad was like a banker or something, and he had this gigantic big mansion.
Yeah.
And the whole theme of Stolen Youth was that when you go to college, like, your youth is stolen, man. Like, your youth is over. Don't let them steal your youth. And that yeah. was kind of like all the lyrics to the song. I didn't write any of those songs.
Yeah.
They were a band, like, before I joined them. And then their lead singer went to college.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they're like, oh, we need a new lead singer. Cause,
that's so funny, yeah.
So I'm like, I always hung out with them when I went to the practices. And they're like, oh, you know all the songs. And, like, you want to come to be our lead singer? I'm like, yeah, totally. And they're like, okay, well, we're a straight edge band and you can't drink. And I'm like, well, that is not going to work. And they're like, okay, well, you can't be drunk while you play. How about that? And I'm like, no. Yeah. They're like, well, how about if you just don't actively drink while you're on stage?
Right.
And I'm like, all right, yeah, I could do that. Yeah. So that was the compromise, and that was my first band.
Gotcha.
And there, it was just really like this stupid social statement they were trying to make, and yeah. that was about the extent of their philosophy.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like they had an ideology left, right, or any otherwise. But that really like got me comfortable being mm-hmm. on stage, and I knew we were huge when we were opening for some big punk band, and we get there and there's a kid in the parking lot who had replicated our logo on the trunk of his car.
Oh, wow.
which I used to draw a lot. Our logo was like this fist,
yeah,
you know, with a spiked wristband and then a big X on the fist for like being a straight edge. And yeah. I had Stolen Youth all stylized around it, and this guy had like replicated it perfectly on the hood of his car. I'm like, wow, we're
that's
huge.
But that was
I think the next guy in line went to college.
Oh, wow.
And then that band was done.
Yeah. That's like the exact antithesis of everything the band stands for.
Exactly.
Supposedly stands for.
No, it was awesome. So it was just maybe a year later
mm-hmm.
that I'm starting to get really, like, fed up with peace punks.
Okay.
They just, like, irritated me beyond belief.
Okay.
And it became like they became what I was rebelling against.
Okay.
So I remember at the time there were some accusations to Coors Brewery that they didn't hire black people or something. Some kind of unfair hiring practices. And all the peace punks are like, don't drink Coors. They're racist. Mm-hmm. Like, we're boycotting Coors. And I didn't care one way or another who they hired or didn't hire, but I hated the peace punks.
Right.
So I would actually...
Transition. Totally. Or transitory property of math.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And so I would spend the extra dollar or two to drink Coors beer, which was a big deal because I was all about quantity, not quality.
Right.
And I would do that just specifically to get at them.
Okay.
And I even had a Coors hat at one point. And so it was outside of a punk show where I'm working on my second 12-pack of Coors, and I got my Coors hat on, and I'm just, like, poking at the peace punks when a friend of mine came and played a White Power skinhead band.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm just like, where has this been all my life?
Yeah.
And it just, like, made the hair on the back of my neck stand up, and I'm just, like, completely enamored with the idea because, first of all, like, the first thing going through my head is like, this will really, really enrage the peace punks.
Sure.
Like, that was the biggest attraction to me. And not just the peace punks, but everybody.
Right.
Like, all of civil society.
Rebellion for its own sake.
Totally. Yeah. All of civil society will be utterly disgusted.
Right.
With what I'm doing here. And the second thing that did appeal to me was, I throughout my entire life, I had this obsession with being a warrior.
Mm.
I when I was a little kid, I read at a very early age, and I'd go to the library and I'd take out books on Greek myths and mm-hmm. Norse myths, and I just want the ones about fighting and monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if there's no fighting in that myth, I'm not interested in it. Right. And I just, like, you know, Perseus and Theseus and Thor and Beowulf. I'm just like, oh yeah. And then as I grow up, I'm really into fantasy stuff. I'm reading a lot, like Conan, and then I start playing D&D, and I'm all into, like, Dungeons and Dragons. I'm like, I'm the warrior. I'm saving, you know, whoever. Or a lot of times I'm like this anti-hero warrior, and I'm just attacking people and sacking towns and whatever. And so now here I am, this alcoholic, angry, rebellion addicted 16-year-old, and this music presents me the opportunity to actually be a warrior for my race, which is apparently under threat from this Jewish conspiracy to kill all the white people on the planet Earth, and they're doing it by moving non-white people into our ancestral white homelands.
Right.
And as ridiculous as that sounds to any thinking human being, which it should, at that point in my life, it was like music to my ears.
Right.
And that's how I initially got into it.
So did you join the group that your friend was in the band?
It actually, we got the music from Chicago.
Okay.
So it was some friends of mine who were also in the punk scene that I knew for years from the punk scene, and who I had spent a lot of time with. Mm-hmm. And we'd go around causing trouble, getting in fights, whatever. And one of them was in Chicago, where she encountered the Chicago area skinheads, which mm-hmm. was like the first white power skinhead crew in the United States. And their leader was this guy, Clark Martel, who was best described as like Manson-esque. He was in early 30s. He was very, very smart, very mm-hmm. charismatic, but absolutely like crazy.
Yeah.
He'd stab you as soon as look at you. And he had always, like, trying to creep on, like, girls and get them into the group. And he's all, you know, making passes at them. And so my friend went down there being a girl. Like, he just, like, dialed into her, and they met her on the street, probably on Belmont or something. And that's where she got a screwdriver tape.
Okay.
And so that was the first white, and that was kind of the seminal white power skinhead band there is. And so she came back to Milwaukee with that tape. Played it for her then boyfriend, now husband, Pat, mm-hmm. and played it for me mm-hmm. and another guy, Clayton. And we were all just like, oh, all of us were like super into this.
Yeah.
And that's when we decided to start our own white power skinhead crew in Milwaukee.
Okay, I see.
So we didn't like join an existing crew really. We were kind of exposed to the ideology by the Chicago group. But shortly after we got started making noise in Milwaukee, like some remnants of the, because the leader of the Chicago group went to prison,
mm-hmm.
it was actually state's evidence turned on him by the woman who would later bear my child.
Oh, wow.
And so the remnants of the Chicago group, like, came up to Milwaukee, like, they're going to come and command us.
Oh.
They're like, oh, yeah, like, they're, you know, well, this is how it is. And we kind of ran them out of town.
I see.
We're like, no, you're not commanding us, and nobody else is. And right. that was kind of always our thing. Like, we were hyper-violent. We were very arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody, like, when we started, like, getting in the newspapers and for beating up people and spray painting swastikas all over the place, all these, like, old school Nazis would come crawling out from under the rocks. And mm-hmm. some of them, like, tried to walk in and just, like, command us, like, mm-hmm. we're their foot soldiers or something.
Yeah.
And they got beat up, like, yeah. badly. Like, that was just how we were. We weren't there for anybody to run. Like, we were running stuff.
Right. So tell me about some of the violent acts you guys did during your run with this group.
Especially in the first few years, it was just like rampant violence
mm-hmm.
that constantly. There were some weeks looking back where I like lost count of how many fights I got into.
Wow.
And some of those fights were just me. I was always a big kid, and I always kind of looked older than mm-hmm. my age. So even when I was like 16, 17, there were some bars I could go drink in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go in these bars, and I'd start drinking, and I'd pick fights with whoever's in the bar.
Yeah. Like,
a lot of times I got my ass kicked, and a lot of times I beat people up. But a lot of the violence was also like we would just go around in the streets like looking for targets of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the targets of opportunity may have been like a black kid standing by himself
mm-hmm.
or somebody we thought was gay or Jewish or most often we would jump on like white frat boys
mm-hmm.
and just beat the snot out of them. And then afterwards we would like justify it by saying, oh, they were listening to Public Enemy.
Oh, wow.
Like, they're a race traitor. And we would have never, ever admitted this back in the day, but Milwaukee has one of the most violent inner cities in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know that. They don't, you think of, you know, Detroit or Baltimore or something, mm-hmm. but Milwaukee is just incredibly depressed inner city and just crushing poverty and, mm-hmm. and segregation. And we were terrified of the inner city, even though we lived on the fringes of it.
Okay.
We were like on this strip of neighborhood between the posh east side of Milwaukee and the inner city north side
mm-hmm.
and this strip was called River West. If we went east, we're going to the east side to fight the frat boys.
Okay.
If we go west, we're going like right into the hood.
Right.
And we never went west.
Right.
Because we were terrified.
Right.
We would have never admitted that.
Yeah.
But when we were looking for trouble, we always went east.
Sure. Did you ever have any aha moments or any sort of not aha moments but introspective moments when you were engaging in the physical acts of violence? Did you ever like pause or hesitate or think about what you were doing?
There's a lot of fights I got into which was kind of like live by the sword kind of stuff.
Okay.
As I wrote about in my first book, like we're crashing some party and some hippie kid hits me in the head with a lead pipe,
right?
And I just destroyed him,
right?
Like I absolutely just lost it, and I feel bad about that, but like it doesn't really haunt me.
Sure.
Like I if you hit me with a lead pipe nowadays, I'm probably still going to defend myself.
Sure.
I'm not going to go to the extreme that I did then.
Right.
But I don't lose a whole lot of sleep over. What I do lose sleep over is a lot of the just random beatings we were involved with.
Mm-hmm.
Where like 10 of us would jump on one kid. And there was moments during that kind of violence where the human being inside of me was like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, why are you doing this? And I didn't have the courage to even acknowledge that voice, okay. much less answer it.
Okay.
And when people ask me why I left, the simple answer is exhaustion.
Okay.
And the exhaustion came from all kinds of angles, but one of the big sources of exhaustion was knowing that what I was doing was wrong
mm-hmm.
and was horrible. And a lot of that, like, drawing on my childhood and being friends with all the black kids in Mequon and being mm-hmm. having a best friend who was Jewish
mm-hmm.
and hanging out with a Filipino kid and, like, just going back to that, and that same voice would be like, are you you don't. Why do you have a problem with black people? Like, right. Black people are getting to you. Yeah. Like, this is all manufactured. All this hatred and separation is all like concocted.
Yeah.
But it speaks for my lack of character at the time that I didn't do anything about it.
Can you unpack that a little bit more? The idea of exhaustion, because you said some of it came from, you know, just physical acts of violence, but what were some other sources of the exhaustion that you experienced?
The exhaustion came from all sorts of angles. The knowledge of my wrongness and the violence was one of them. I think addiction just simply is another one. Mm-hmm. Like just this whole, and it sounds like kind of innocuous. Yes, I was addicted to beer.
Yeah,
but that's what it was. I was like physically addicted to it, and just constantly like having to find it and drink it, and then find the rest of them and try to function when you're all hungover, and that was all very much tied into the culture of being a neo-Nazi skinhead. Mm-hmm. And we'd even like justify it, be like, well, you know, drugs are for non-whites. But alcohol's like the white man's like, we invented beer. Not true at all. But like, beer is something the white man invented. Liquor, the white man invented. Not true whatsoever. But it was just one of the many like lies we would tell ourselves. And those lies also became a source of exhaustion as well.
Right.
Because you're trying to adopt this fundamentalist ideology that says white people are superior and at war with everyone. And as you go through your day-to-day life, like you constantly barrage with all this information that doesn't jibe with that.
Right.
So you're constantly blocking that information out.
Right.
It's like you have this active process, like a little kid sitting there with thumbs in their ears going, nah, 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 I don't hear you. That's exhausting. I really found it exhausting to have to cut myself off from culture that I had once loved. I grew up and I remain a huge like film, TV, music, even sports nerd.
Okay.
I lived in Wisconsin. I love the Green Bay Packers.
Right.
Can't watch a Packer game on Sunday.
Why?
Because they're black guys and white guys on the same team, and it's not very white power friendly.
Goes deep.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah. And not only that, but it's like not only can you not watch it and enjoy it, and of course it's not just the integrated team, it's this whole thing about, well, the Jews own the NFL and they own TV, and it's all part of this Jewish plot to like zombie out white men so that they don't it's very interesting. A lot of these narratives come right in line with like far left narratives today, like, oh, this is all just stuff to pacify the people so that we don't rise up and smash our oppressors.
Right. Yeah, but, it's very eerily.
But the people was the white man.
Right.
The people was the white race.
Right.
That was why football was frowned upon, as was all TV, as was anything out of Hollywood.
I see.
We used to say, like, oh, if you look at the credits of a movie or a TV show, it reads like a Tel Aviv phone book. and be like, well, see, look at all these Jews in there. Look at all the Jews. And being, like, willfully ignorant that for thousands of years, Jewish people have been barred from your normal trades.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be a carpenter. You can't be a plumber.
Right.
You can't be any of these trades. You can't work in construction. So, of course, they're going to work in whatever area they can work in.
Right.
And a lot of that happened to be Hollywood. A lot of it happened to be banking.
Right.
even though all the huge big banks were founded by WASPs.
Right.
that's another part of the exhaustion is like you're constantly spinning not only what you
was there sources of information though that were coming in as you were being fed this sort of bigoted talking points. Were there other sort of talking points countering that you kept hearing and sort of kept trying to shut out?
Well, yeah, and it would come from pop culture stuff.
Oh, okay.
One of my favorite examples, and I literally, like, this is a really important part of my life. The show Seinfeld helped save my life.
Wow.
I was, when Seinfeld came out, I was like in the, actually tail end of my hate group stuff. I think it was 91, 92. I got out in 94. But I was living with my girlfriend, who was also a skinhead, and she worked nights. And Seinfeld was on 8 p.m. on Channel 4 Thursday nights. And I had to tape it for her because she loved it also. And if she got home and it wasn't taped, she'd be really angry with me. And we couldn't very well write Seinfeld on the spine of the tape.
Right.
Because if that was seen on our bookshelf
right.
by my guys, like that would be used against me.
Right.
To
what'd you guys write on it?
We wrote Amber's second birthday party because
oh.
we knew no one would ask to watch that. So that's like where we hit our Seinfeld episodes.
Wow. Yeah.
And as ridiculous as that was, none of which was lost on me.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like Seinfeldian in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be an episode.
Yeah.
The nature of the show,
mm-hmm.
Which is like quintessential Jewish humor.
Yeah.
Larry David, Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Like, and then Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Jason Alexander, like yeah. all these Jewish people involved in the show. Because it was like observational and kind of day-to-day life, me, like everybody else during that time, was I'd watch Seinfeld Thursday night, and then the next Tuesday,
yeah.
I'd be eating soup, and then I'm thinking of the soup Nazi, like, right. ha ha ha. Like, you know, all this somebody gets too close to you when they're talking, oh, a close talker, ha ha. Right. Like, yeah, all these little references come up every single day.
Yeah.
And every time they did,
slowly but surely, start infiltrating.
Exactly, it was. And it's funny because this is exactly what the white power ideology accuses mm-hmm. Jews of doing. And mm-hmm. so, yes, indeed, Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David did like pollute my mind with this Jewish humor and blah blah blah. But what it brought up was really poignant, painful questions I would ask myself.
Okay.
Which was, so here I am spending 7 years being this rabid, violent anti-Semite, saying everything wrong with the world is because of Jews, and they have to go. And we would always dance around the Holocaust. First, we'd deny the Holocaust, and then when people say, oh, do you want to exterminate all Jews? They're like, well, you know, we're not going to exterminate them, but once the white man stops supporting them, they will wither like grapes on the vine.
Mm.
And we would say that about non-white people as well. And so I would ask myself, I'm like, oh, so in your whiter and brighter world, does Jerry Seinfeld get to live there?
Right.
And if he did, do you think he'd be very funny?
Yeah.
After you're letting all these other Jews wither on the vine, you know, maybe with a little push and shove here and there.
Right.
And that was a really hard question to answer. And I couldn't answer it with anything but, actually, my life is a more joyful process because of Jerry Seinfeld
right.
and Larry David.
Right.
Like, that's, period.
Right.
That's the answer to that question. So what implications does that have
right.
on the broader question of my anti-Semitism?
Right. It's cognitive dissonance.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. So that was exhausting. But what was most exhausting and really what a lot of my work focuses on nowadays is when people who I claim to hate treated me with kindness.
Mm.
Which is one of the reasons what your New York Times piece just resonated with me so yeah. much, because it was like that kind of bravery that you talk about and that your parents kind of instilled in you.
Definitely, yeah.
Was like what changed the course of my life. It was people like a Jewish boss, a lesbian supervisor, black and Latino coworkers, people who the whole thing about being a skinhead is that you're like radiating the hatred.
Right.
You don't go walking around like dressed normal, acting like you're undercover all right. week, and then on Saturday you put your Klan hood on.
Right.
Like when you're a skinhead all day, every day, you're walking around going, I hate you.
Right.
I hate blacks. I hate Jews. I hate gay people. Like that's, you might, sometimes you do have that written on your head.
Yeah.
I had a shaved head. I had swastika tattoos on me. I had swastikas on my jacket. You didn't have to be very sharp to put two and two together and understand who I was.
Right.
And yet there were these very brave people who defied what I was trying to do.
Right.
And I really like dial in on this nowadays in all my talks and in all anything I do on media, because everybody like wants to fight.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, whoa, I'm going to punch Nazis. You know, we're going to smash the oppressors. We're going to yeah. do this and that. And I'm like, that's not helping.
Yeah.
Like that is when you reflect the aggression
right.
of violent racists, you're literally putty in their hands.
Right.
Like that's exactly what they're trying to provoke. Without jumping too much, but just because this happened a few days ago,
sure.
this Christchurch shooter who murdered 50 people thinks that and in his manifesto, he goes on and on about how he's fighting back against ISIS.
Right.
He's fighting against this Islamic terror. And it's like he's not fighting. He might as well be one of them.
Right.
He is absolutely aiding and abetting them.
Right.
He is doing exactly what they're trying to provoke.
Right.
So this idea that like you can somehow out hate Nazis.
Right.
It's just I get it. Like I can imagine what it's like to be the target of that hatred.
Yeah.
And it's the phrase the hate that hate made comes to mind.
Right.
I get that, but the fact is beyond just like the kumbaya, we're all human beings, let's love each other, which I think has a lot of importance.
Sure.
And I think we need to really get more dialed into that than getting reverting into tribalism. But beyond that, the reflection of aggression is tactically wrong.
Right.
Like you're not going to accomplish anything good doing that.
Right.
And so when people treated me with kindness when I least deserved it, they were defying me.
Right.
It's a different kind
of attack.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is absolutely warriorship.
Yeah.
Because it's very hard to do.
Yeah. Is there a specific story that you have that you could tell us?
Yeah, I got a ton of them. Probably the most popular story in this genre is the sweet old black lady who worked at McDonald's story.
Okay.
And this happened when I was very early on in my 7-year involvement in hate groups. And I, because I'm a gifted genius, it occurred to me that if I ate nothing but ramen noodles, I'd have more drinking money. And I don't mean like the good, like $20
bowl. I thought you were gonna be like, I could save money. I could save up for something.
It was the same money, but it was for drinking.
Beer.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't like the good, like $20 bowl of really legit ramen that you get here in New York City. It was like the 10 for a dollar brick.
Sure.
And just like something that does nothing more than fill your stomach.
Right.
And the one day of the week where I would have something else was on payday when I would go to McDonald's and get a Big Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this McDonald's by the place where I cashed my check. And when I walked in there, I was just kind of stunned by this elderly black woman who was behind the counter taking orders. And I was stunned because she had this beautiful smile on her face that was like so genuine and authentic. And it was just there for everyone. It was like the sun. Like the sun doesn't care what color your skin is. You're a gangbanger, white power skinhead, rich, poor, gay, straight. The sun just shines on everybody.
Yeah.
And that's how her smile was. And it made me really uncomfortable. Because I'm trying to hate black people, and here's this sweet elderly woman with this smile. Like, how could anybody hate her?
Yeah.
And I couldn't.
Yeah.
I was powerless to hate her. And so I wanted my Big Mac, so I go in there and I order, and she's super nice and really like making my skin crawl the whole time. And so I scurry out of there. A week goes by. I'm drinking, fighting, eating ramen noodles, yelling white power, printing T-shirts. It was my job. And then payday comes again. I go back to the same McDonald's. There she is again.
Mm-hmm.
This time she remembers me.
Mm-hmm.
She remembers what I ordered. She remembers I drank Diet Coke.
Mm-hmm.
She's talking about the weather. She's asking me about my day. And I'm just like completely just stammering like, yeah, okay, fine. And I get my food and like just get out of there.
Yeah.
Because I'm very busily, diligently trying to like create this identity of who I am as a white warrior who fights for his people and hates black people. And like, here's this little old lady like blowing it all out of the water.
Yeah.
A week goes by again. In between paydays this time, again, another example of gifted genius, I get a swastika tattooed on my middle finger.
Oh.
Which
is
since
there?
It's since been covered up and then removed.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But the logic was that if somebody got in my face, as I'm trying to provoke constantly, I would show them the middle finger and be like, what are you going to do?
Right.
Like, let's brawl. And I certainly was not thinking of the sweet old black lady who worked at McDonald's when I got the tattoo.
Sure.
And it didn't occur to me until I'm walking in for my payday Big Mac that I see her again and I freeze in the doorway, like involuntarily. And I put my hand in my pocket and I'm like, I don't want her to see this.
Well, yeah.
And I'm not even like going into that, but I'm trying to escape.
Yeah.
I'm like, first of all, I'm like, does anybody else work here? Like, she's always here. And I'm trying to like wait to see if somebody else comes to the counter. They don't. And then I'm trying to think like, where's the next closest McDonald's?
Right.
Like, I'm getting ready to like walk because I'm so the idea of her seeing that tattoo was just absolutely like crushing to me.
Yeah. It's almost as if you knew that if she, well, you can tell me if this is true or not, but it sounds like it's almost as if you knew that if she saw that and was disappointed in you,
Yeah.
That would have had an effect.
Oh, yeah.
On your feeling about yourself.
Right.
Right. Which is real cognitive dissonance.
Oh, it totally right? was. That it a black totally woman. Was. Right.
Yeah.
I felt like I did when my grandma would yell at me.
Right.
Like, when, for beating up my little brother, which I did all the time. Yeah. And I love my grandma.
Yeah.
My world is revolved around her. But she'd be like, and she was real gentle. But she's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that to your brother? And I felt like this big when she asked me. And so there weren't any McDonald's close, and it was December, and it was cold out. And I'm eventually the siren song of the Big Mac prevails. And I go walking up to the counter, and I order, and she's super nice again. And I'm thinking, if I just keep my hand in my pocket, she won't see it. Mm-hmm. Not thinking I have to get my money out.
Right.
So I'm trying to get my money out without showing the top of my hand and this real like contorted spin trying to do that. And as I take my money out, she sees it and she just goes, what is that on your finger? Mm. And I just froze and all I could do was look down at my steel-toed boots. And I was like already 6'3" by then. I was a good foot taller than her.
Yeah.
And
wow, and she's still like,
oh yeah, I was just at her mercy, and I'm just like, I can't even look at her. I'm just looking down at my boots. And I go, it's nothing. And she waits for me to look up, and when I do, she looks me right in the eye, and she just goes, I know that's not who you are.
Mm.
You're a better person than that.
Mm. You know what this reminds me of? I have to say, I have to say this because this is the Theory of Enchantment podcast.
Yeah,
and the second principle of the Theory of Enchantment is criticize to uplift and empower, never to tear down and never to destroy.
Yes.
And one of the things that I teach when I teach the Theory of Enchantment is the story of Maya Angelou and Tupac, because there's a story goes where Tupac was on set about to fight someone, and you know obviously Maya Angelou was not approving of this, so she pulls him over to the side and essentially says to him the same thing that woman said to you.
Wow.
Which is essentially like, I know this is in you, and also you are the future. Like, we are looking to you, my generation is looking to you to pave a new path. So it's like amazing to me how the parallels that exist and the patterns that exist in terms of people being transformed from one sort of lifestyle to a different lifestyle.
Wow. Yeah, it is enchantment.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, such a powerful thing.
Yeah.
And so, like, strong.
It's so strong. People don't realize that how strong the strength that is required to do something like that or to say something like that.
Right.
And how did you respond when she told you that?
I couldn't even say anything. I just, like, grabbed my food and I ran out of that McDonald's.
Yeah.
Like, I was so discombobulated by that. And, yeah. I always say I would love to say I went like skipping out of there,
right,
going, racism's stupid. Right. Like, she was so nice. I'm all changed.
Right.
But a really important part of what I teach, and I'm interested to know if this like is part of your theory of entrapment also, is just the truth of cultivation.
Mm.
In that this exchange I had with this woman, which took all of like 45 seconds, maybe.
Sure.
It at the time, it made me run away from her for one.
Right.
And I ran home and I got as drunk as I could, as fast as I could.
Mm-hmm.
I went out on the streets and picked a fight with the first person I could find.
Mm-hmm.
I blasted my white power music. I'm just like, I need to put as much space emotionally, mentally, spiritually as I can between me and the singularity of inhumanity that I just encountered.
Sure.
Trying to pretend it never happened.
Sure.
But the human psyche does not work in terms of subtraction.
Right.
Like, if it did, there'd be no need for therapists.
Right.
Like, the whole...
That's a very good point. Yes.
The nature of our being is that once something happens to us, it is part of our experience from that day forward.
Right.
And the only thing we can change is how we look at it.
Right.
How we process it. We can change the meaning of something, but we can't change the experience of it itself.
Right.
And so, for 7 years... In addition to all the other exhaustion, I'm constantly trying to suppress the memory of what this woman said to me. And it became, as all the exhaustion piled up, that seed like started to grow.
Wait, this is crazy. Okay, I have to bring up another thing now
that
you're saying this. Because I'm realizing that there's a parallel between this story and another story that I teach, which is fictional, but still very much related. Because it comes from a Disney movie comes from the movie Moana. I don't know if you've seen it.
Probably watched it with my daughter when she was a kid, but okay. I don't recall it.
So it came out recently. It came out like 2 years ago.
Then I did.
Okay, so it's interesting because you just said that almost as if the seed that she planted in you gnawed at you for 7 years. That's a long time.
It is.
That's a long time to gnaw at someone. But that specific statement that she made, what was the statement again? Say it again that she said to you.
She said, "I know that's not who you are. You're a better person than
I
that.
Know that's not who you are." So let's focus on that. So in Moana, you should still watch it. It's amazing.
I will.
The parallels. This is a spoiler alert, but you should still
okay,
watch it.
Okay.
Moana is all about this young woman who has to go defeat an evil goddess named Tika, who's full of rage and full of, like, you know, anger.
Right.
And she has to bring back another goddess who left. Her name is Tafiti, and she's, like, the green goddess and the restorative, you know, goddess of gardening or whatever.
Right on.
To restore the island, essentially.
Okay.
And it's interesting because in your story, it took 7 years, more or less. But in the Disney, it's a Disney movie, so it's not going to take 7 years. It's going to take a scene, right? Essentially. But she has an aha moment, and she realizes, Moana realizes, that Tika and Tafiti are the same goddesses.
Mm.
And the heart sort of was removed from her, and so she descended into this mad descent of rage. But what's interesting is that in the scene where she has this aha moment, she says literally, word for word, "This is not who you are."
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? That's insane. This is enchantment. Okay, continue. That's insane, though.
That is certainly enchantment. Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Well, and what a powerful thing to, like, to even contemplate.
Mm-hmm.
And to present to somebody.
Yes.
Like, rather than, you know, you're wrong,
right,
blah, 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 like, butting heads about, like, a policy issue,
right,
just, like, really ask, even to ask, like, is that really who you are?
Yeah.
It is.
7 years.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
It was 7 years later that I'm looking for an excuse to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Because all this exhaustion has piled up and piled up, and it's all, like, interdependent also.
Mm-hmm.
After I had this experience at McDonald's, like, the next time I'm attacking someone arbitrarily, like, that's in my head.
Right.
Her asking.
Constantly.
Her saying that.
Yeah.
And it kind of carries more and more weight each time.
Right.
And the more I try to suppress it, the more weight it carries.
Right.
So after 7 years, I'm looking for an excuse to leave. The reason I need an excuse to leave is because in the movement, as we called it, I was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I was the lead singer of Centurion. I was one of the first Hammerskins. I was a reverend in this racial holy war. Mm-hmm. Like, I had status.
Very, very Nation of Islam-esque. It's very interesting.
We were actually big fans of the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
We were like, oh, they're black guys who hate white people and Jews? Like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, more of that.
Yeah.
Please. I remember a buddy of mine lived, we always lived on kind of the fringes of the hood because mm-hmm. it was all we could afford and mm-hmm. we were too afraid to really go into the hood. But, a buddy of mine lived, like, kind of on the fringes, and all the time, like, on the way to his house, there were Nation of Islam guys at the intersection selling the newspaper
mm-hmm.
that they had. And I would always stop, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, here, I'd buy one from them. I'm like, yeah, hey, keep doing what you're doing. And then he'd kind of look
That's
at me. And,
wild.
He'd look at me, and he'd be like, yeah, okay. And you know, we kind of had this moment of, like, yeah, we're on the same page about a lot of stuff, aren't we? There's all kinds of parallels there. And mm-hmm. and it reminds me, too, I work in counter-violent extremism nowadays, and so I address violent extremism of all sorts. Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking far right, far left, which is certainly a thing, despite mm-hmm. a lot of people saying the contrary, or religious mm-hmm. or racial, like, it's all the same narrative.
Yeah, it's the same patterns.
It is, absolutely.
I've noticed that across these different categories, it's the same patterns.
Yep.
Which are sort of rooted in the human condition, I think. So you needed an excuse to get out because you were super popular.
Right.
And So how did you get out?
Well, it was basically looking my life in the movement, VIP, international skinhead, war god, rock star. Outside of the movement, I'm an alcoholic high school dropout who works a menial factory job.
I see. So the movement gets
can't
you
pay
meaning.
His bills. And has a habit of drinking until he passes out and pissing all over himself.
Right.
Like, that's who I am in real life. And the idea of, like, giving up all this status and, like, really facing the harsh reality of the holes I've dug for myself, it was pretty imposing.
Sure.
So that's kind of what put me in a position where, like, I can't just go. Like, I need something to happen. And what happened was when my daughter was 18 months old, her mother and I broke up. I became a single parent. Her mother moved away to live by her previous two daughters and their dad, who was down in Key West. And a couple months later, a second friend of mine was murdered in a street fight that happened after a show that my band played on. So by that time, I lost count how many friends had been incarcerated. And it hit me that if I didn't change my ways, death or prison was going to take me from my daughter. So that was like... That was me walking away from that life and walking away from that ideology. And right away, there was good things and bad things right away. But for the most part, it was almost like a hedonistic thing.
Okay.
Leaving. I'm like, I can watch Seinfeld.
Right.
I can root for the Packers. Like, right. Go Pack. Yeah, I can go put a cheese head on. Like, right. I can go watch movies.
Right.
I can listen to the Beastie Boys again.
Right.
And while I kind of like traded all my friends for that, it was also pretty apparent to me by that point that a lot of them weren't really friends. Like a lot of them were more messed up than I was.
Okay.
And that it was only this hatred that was holding us together. And it Pardeep and I do a lot of like corporate stuff nowadays, and and the big thing for corporations, which I think is great, is like, let's have a purpose-driven organization.
Sure.
Like, are we just going to make widgets, or are we going to be like making the world a better place while we make and sell our widgets?
Sure.
And in order to do that, you really adopt a corporate culture that leads you in that direction.
Right.
So like, we want our corporate culture to be compassion and kindness and gratitude, which can be really transformative for a business. It supercharges customer service. It makes people happy to come to work. They get along better. Our corporate culture, this white power hate group, was literally hate and violence.
Right.
So like our organization reflected that.
Yeah.
And we were fighting each other as often as we were fighting anybody else. Now, there were a number of guys I knew from back then who, like, I saved their lives in street fights, and they saved my life. And we were very close. But we were also dysfunctional personally that we couldn't really have an authentic friendship when you got all that other stuff swimming around.
Sure.
So it leaving the friends like wasn't as bad as you may have thought, and they were all getting burnt out too. Our group itself had like cannibalized itself and self-destructed so much by 94 that it was really just like me and the guys in my band and maybe 5-6 other guys that I knew from way back in the day who all still hung out. And like when we had our peak of 150 people, they were all out doing things that like made our stomach turn. And also that made us worry, like, these guys are idiots. They're all going to get busted. They know all the dumb shit we did. And now, you know, they're going to go turn state on us. And so we just started, like, by the time I left, we'd already distanced ourselves from the bulk of the people in the movement locally. And then after I left, I had one friend who kind of like dipped his toes in the skinhead thing and then got out real quick.
Okay.
Interestingly, when I interviewed him for the first book, I was like, dude, I didn't really got the story when he left. I'm like, what made you leave? And he's like, dude, you ever try to get laid as like a white power skinhead? You like walk up to a bunch of girls and be like, hey, so yeah, you know, white power. Like, just like, that it was interfering with his ability to like connect with women.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of true, actually. Yeah. It's not really.
Missed that part. Overlooked that part. Yeah.
Right. So he had been out for a while already by the time I got out. And he was like my only friend. And he lived on the college campus in Milwaukee with a bunch of like hippie college kids. And I'd go over there and I'm just like, wow, you know, like everybody's sitting around like partying, but nobody's like hating each other. Like it's not about, idea. Yeah, it was like really amazing to me. Yeah. And I wanted to be over there all the time to the point where the guy's like, no, you can't come over that often. Yeah. Like just go find something else to do. And then, my friend started going to rave parties in Chicago and on Saturdays. So when I want to hang out on Saturdays, like, oh, he's like, I'm going to Chicago. You should come. And I'm like, no. I was scared to death. Yeah.
Oh, and I remember this part.
Yeah. I write about it in depth in the first book. And that was one of my favorite chapters to write.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite ones to read also. But eventually I kind of caved in and I went down to South Side of Chicago with him and found ourselves in this like dilapidated old roller rink with like 3,000 people of every possible ethnicity and sexual identity, gender identity, socioeconomic background you can imagine, shaking our ass to house music all night long till like 6 a.m. and it was one of the most amazing things I've ever experienced in my life.
That really resonates with me because I like love that scene here in New York, and I also frequent those sort of places in New York, especially in Brooklyn.
Right on.
And I, you know, I'm not from here. I'm from New Orleans. I moved here almost 4 years ago, but my sort of immersion into that scene has been, for me personally, like a life-changing experience. And it's like very religious almost, and like totally transcendental in some ways, and it really affected how I sort of assess. I mean, that scene has informed my development of the theory of enchantment, my sort of understanding of human relationships and the breaking down of human relationships, because there's a question that I always used to ask was like, what is the, this was the question that really was the catalyst for developing the theory of enchantment. What is the psychology of connection here that's going on here? Because like it's a DJ, these people probably in the crowd, many of them don't know each other, and yet they're willing to forego a lot of the usual, you know, don't stand so close to me, to just lose themselves in rapture to this music. And what is this psychology of connection that's happening? And can I take the psychology of connection and apply it in a space where there's disconnection?
Wow.
So can I take it off of the dance floor, whatever's going on, figure out what's going on there, and synthesize it into whether it's principles, whether it's practiced habits over time to generate connection.
Wow.
So I definitely relate to that particular chapter that you wrote, and I remember it because I had a similar experience as well.
That's like mind blowing. Yeah. Absolutely. but not surprising.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I experienced in the rave scene was like, I still had swastikas all over me back then.
So fascinating. People were just like dancing.
I'll never forget. One time I'm sitting on the floor of some filthy warehouse. It's like 4 a.m. and this girl has my forearm in her lap, which as you're looking at it now, it's like this demon guy tattoo. But underneath that, there is a pile of skulls and swastikas. You can kind of see the diagonal lines in the skulls. And she's looking at this tattoo of skulls and swastikas. It says white power. There's a bust of an SS guy there. And she's kind of run her hand over it. And she's like, what's that about? And I'm like, well, I used to be a Nazi skinhead. I feel really bad about it.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, you're not anymore, are you? And I'm like, no. And she's like, okay. Like, just like back to the beat. Like, that's
amazing.
All it was.
It's the power of music.
Oh, it totally was. And everywhere I went, the people in the rave scene like forgave me and accepted me and embraced me like on the spot.
Yeah.
With absolutely.
That's a very self-selecting community.
Oh, it totally is. It totally is.
I have been in spaces where I am like floored by that immediate impulse.
Right. Right.
That is a part of that scene.
Well, and in Chicago too, like that was when they'd still had a lot of outlaws.
Okay.
So like in places where like we were supposed to be there all night and the promoter, so there's no bar, there's no drinks.
Uh-huh.
And like any good promoter would have like a huge barrel full of water bottles or something, just like so everybody's keep hydrated or whatever. And it was probably wasn't very sanitary, but I remember like you'd be just like dancing, going nuts, and you're dying of thirst, and somebody'd be like, "Here, bro," and just like give you a bottle of water. And you're like, "Oh, thanks," and then you give it back to them, and then they're drinking it. Like everybody's just drinking out of the same bottle of water, and just woohoo!
This was your Burning Man light experience.
It totally was. And this was, I gotta say too, I'm not a burner. I've never been.
Yeah.
It is kind of a bucket list thing.
Yeah.
At the same time, I do kind of got like the elitist, like, yeah, back in my day, like our 4-day techno festivals were $20.
Yeah, that's true.
And we had, you know, we had 5,000 people there, and it was all like outlaw real DJs and not like, you know, these multi-million-dollar installations and stuff. But at the same time, I don't want to get too elitist and like knock it. But especially if that vibe's there, like I got no problem with money and people that have money. That's cool.
Yeah. It's just interesting how I've also never been. I've been told by friends that I should probably check out the scene because I probably like it. But I don't know. Like, the wilderness is not my favorite climate, you know? So I don't know. Okay, so I guess this can – maybe this is the last question.
Sure.
What commentary – or it's a two-part question. What commentary would you give to sort of address the current climate? Because – we have, you know, what happened in New Zealand last week. Mm. We have in this country, I think there's increasingly, and this could be my fault of staying on Twitter too long, because I do think Twitter is a bubble and doesn't necessarily reflect what the majority of people are thinking. But like, there is this knee-jerk reaction that I've seen on Twitter to white people, first of all, which is very disturbing to me. Like, just the idea of white people doing things has received this culturally acceptable backlash on Twitter, which is weird to me and doesn't vibe at all with anything that you've talked about in terms of your experience of how you got out the white power movement in the first place.
Right.
So any commentary on that, and just any advice that you would actually give to people who are still in that movement, who may also have that voice gnawing at them, telling them, you know, this is not who you are, any advice that you would give to them?
Absolutely. Well, as the first part of the question, I guess this is a kind of a disclaimer.
Sure.
I went to University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee for 3 years from 2007 to 2010. Mm-hmm. Didn't graduate, but I went from being an information science major to a community education major.
Mm-hmm.
So in community education, I'm taking peace studies and anti-racist education.
Sure.
And so I've read a lot of books.
Sure.
And written a lot of papers on white privilege and whiteness and mm-hmm. critical race. I notice it's studies now.
Yeah.
It used to be theory then.
Right.
Now it's studies. So I'm very well versed in the entire ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, when I got out of college,
yeah,
I was like, fuck white people.
Right.
I was like, yeah, you know, my privilege and rah, 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 rah. Like, yeah. I was totally bought into it. I was woke before woke was cool.
Before that vocabulary word.
Exactly. Like, before it really was a thing.
Yeah.
And what changed that for me was actually, like, working in Milwaukee's inner city.
Mm.
And also working with people worldwide to try to counter violent extremism.
Right.
And it really boils down to violent extremism, along with systemic racism,
mm-hmm.
along with patriarchy,
mm-hmm.
along with oppression. Mm-hmm. Like, all these things, they all have a prerequisite of separatism.
Okay.
Without that separatism, none of them function.
Right.
And essentially, when somebody says to me, like, we're more different than alike, and you can't understand what I've been through because of the color of your skin,
mm-hmm.
it's a form of separatism.
Right, I see what you're saying.
It fosters separatism.
Right.
So for people who – and another kind of core principle that I've come to adopt that is really explains my problem with woke orthodoxy and mm-hmm. the whole social justice scene is this idea of being anti-whatever.
Right.
Like, I'm an anti-racist. I'm an anti-fascist. And I'm, and this is Dharma 101. Like, you, there can be no self without the non-self elements to define it.
Sure.
So if somebody says they're an anti-racist, I'm like, okay, so without racism, you don't exist.
Right.
Like, you can't even define who you are and what you're about. And yeah, that's a privileged thing to say, but I've learned that from Black people.
Right. That's interesting.
You mentioned Daryl Davis.
Yeah.
Daryl's a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he's one of my greatest teachers among many.
Mm-hmm.
So everything I've learned from listening to people who would score very high in the intersectional Olympics.
Sure.
From listening to people who have lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to me to bear witness to suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Auschwitz. I've been to Utøya Island, where Breivik murdered 69 people. I've been to Srebrenica, where 8,000 Bosniaks were murdered by Serbs. I have dear friends who are survivors of the Rwandan genocide, and I've read their books, and I've done a lot of work with them. I've worked with a lot of Holocaust survivors. And when I work with these survivors and with people who had really, people who have lost children.
Right.
Like, they're the last ones who are going to say, well, you can't understand me.
Right.
Even though they have, like, probably the best, most right to say
right.
that. So learning from them, I see, first of all, I see the harm that separatism causes.
Right.
None of those atrocities I just mentioned leading all the way up to Christchurch and going back to Tree of Life, to Emmanuel AME, to the mosque in Quebec, to Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Like, none of those things can function without that separatism.
Right.
So I just, my problem with, like, taking white people to task is that it fosters that separatism and makes our society more conducive to that kind of violence.
Right. It's sort of a feedback loop.
It is. Absolutely. Almost. Not only that, working in counterviolent extremism, I'm actually here in New York for a NYPD conference on cyber terrorism. Working in counterviolent extremism, I am quite often asked to, like, break down the radicalization process.
Okay.
How does someone become radicalized into a violent extremist ideology of any sort? And what I've come up with after doing this for 9 years all over the world is that it's a push and pull process.
Okay.
So if you use the so-called Islamic State as an example, because that's kind of like, that's the thing of violent extremism, the members of that group are pulling people in with their mantras, with their slick, like, memes and social media, and also, like, face-to-face conversations.
Sure.
That's the pull part.
Sure.
But that radicalization process can't happen without a push happening also.
Right.
And so they need all the non-Muslims on earth to hate all the Muslims on earth. Like, all the violence they commit is meant to make your day-to-day Muslim guy's life miserable.
Right.
It's meant to provoke violence, like what happened in Christchurch.
Right.
And they can't do that by themselves.
Right.
They need Joe pissed off white guy to come be their agent. And that's exactly what that fool in New Zealand did.
Right.
He was putty in their hands. That's the push element.
Mm.
Now, the same thing happens with the white power movement.
Mm.
We talked about these oppression narratives earlier on.
Sure.
You know, we're trying to rouse our people to rise up and fight against this oppression that's holding us down. And the narrative of white supremacist oppression is that white people are the victims.
Right.
And white people are oppressed.
Right.
And when you're a white kid and you go to college nowadays, and there's some colleges, honestly, where you have to take a course in your whiteness.
Right.
and if you don't, like, buy into this lock, stock, and barrel and ask what hoops you need to jump through in order to be an ally, you are, like, by default a Nazi.
Right.
I don't know how many young Muslim kids I worked with who were treated like terrorists.
And so they became.
And they said, if you're going to treat me that way, I might as well be a terrorist.
So another Maya Angelou quote.
Right on. Beautiful.
Maya Angelou is my spirit animal, if you can't tell. Maya Angelou said, if you tell someone over and over again that they are nothing, that they account for nothing, that they are less than nothing, they will eventually say to you, oh, you think I am nothing? I will show you where nothing comes. And then they will become even worse than how you have accused them of being.
That nails it.
Isn't that powerful?
That's exactly what it is.
So
when you, and I have to say this, we need to talk about whiteness.
Yeah.
What the hell is whiteness? Who's white?
Sure.
Who's not? What does whiteness mean? What has it meant for human society over the past 500 years? Mm-hmm. Like, we got to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. They're difficult conversations to have. Mm-hmm. That's what the whole idea of, like, white fragility is.
Right.
Like, well, white fragility is white people are afraid to talk about race. Are we talking about race, or are we having a unilateral, like, this is what's up, and you either agree or you're a Nazi?
Right.
That's not a different discussion. Exactly. Right. And so what happens is you got five white kids in university. Two of them buy into their privilege checking and go off in that direction. The other three are like, I don't really agree with this. So there's no middle ground.
Right.
They have nowhere
to go.
There's
no space for them to go.
And then you got the alt-right over here saying, yeah, we do identity politics for white people.
Right.
Come on over by us.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to do that than it is to do that difficult work to, like, look at the historical suffering that race has caused and continues to cause.
Sure.
So my huge issue with things that are plainly anti-white, mm-hmm. Even though, like, if you say anti-white, no, you're Nazi now.
Right.
Even though, like, you know, read The Root or whatever. Right. People are like, you know, they call them white people or...
Oh, right, yeah.
Like, these little phrases.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, just, like, vicious, like, yeah. White, get out of here. Rah, yeah. I'm melanated. It's...
By the way, that's... I think that's coming from something happening within them.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, there's a correlation here.
It totally is.
Yeah,
it's... hurt people hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that the construct of race has caused massive, massive suffering for 500 years.
Yeah.
And there's all that historical weight behind it, and it's still causing suffering. And so I can't blame anyone who's hurting for acting that way. But again, what I question is, like, what are you trying to bring about?
Right.
I have a personal mission statement, which is I want to bring about a society where all people are valued and included.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I do, and I'm not perfect. There's all kinds of times where I ask myself, does that work towards your mission statement, what mm-hmm. you just did?
Yeah.
And I'll be like, no, it doesn't. Sorry. Yeah. I'm going to try to do better.
Yeah.
But, like, I think it's important for people, especially if you're activist-oriented, like, really get an idea of the society you want to bring about.
Definitely.
And then ask yourself if what you're doing is working toward that. So we can't just, like, pretend race doesn't exist. I'm not colorblind.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't think it's possible for race to exist without racism.
Right.
It's just, as long as there is race, there will be racism.
Sure.
So you can't very well be anti-racist and then go, there's all the white people, there's all the black people.
Right.
The black people can do whatever they want. The white people can't do this, this, and this, and they have to do this, this, and this.
Right.
Like, that's, you're not diminishing
right.
the race that racism comes from.
Right.
So it's sure, it's easy for me to say that because I'm a straight white guy. I get it.
Yeah.
I don't think it makes it any less true. And then as far as the last part of your question, I think what I tell people who are in the movement still is that I live their life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for 7 years, I've been where they have been. And I've heard everything that they have to say a million times.
Mm-hmm.
I've said it a million times, probably better than they'll ever say it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know what it's like to live my life.
Mm.
So we're in New York City now. This is one of my favorite places on the planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here about once a month.
Mm-hmm.
I may end up moving here, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the many reasons I love this city is just because of, like, the hyper diversity
sure.
that you encounter everywhere.
Sure.
And not just, like, bougie Manhattan,
right.
you know, seeing everybody from all over the world, but, like, all these little, like, neighborhoods and
yeah.
enclaves where there's, like, literally every country on the planet kind
yeah.
of recreated in microcosm. That are, like, open and that people go
sure.
in and out of and that, like, kind of merge together and create this very unique place.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's just, like, this is my dream place to be.
Yeah.
And it's because I've practiced a love for diversity for well over 2 decades.
Mm-hmm.
But also because I never lose sight of the fact that 30 years ago, walking down the exact same block I'm about to walk down when we leave here, I would be terrified.
Mm.
And the only thing that's changed is New York City's changed a bit in the past 30 years, but the main thing that's changed has been my lens that I look at the world through. And no one is responsible for that lens but me.
Right.
And so once I understand that, like, well, if my lens tells me that white people are different and superior and at war with everybody else, what's the effect is that going to have on my reality?
Right.
Whereas if my lens tells me that this experience, this human experience that we all co-create with each moment is a primally, basically good thing that you can always be grateful for no matter what, how is that going to affect my life?
Right. And your reality will change according to the lens.
Absolutely.
That you choose to sort of wear. It depends upon, you know, what frames, what glasses you choose
exactly
to wear.
Exactly.
And that is how you will see the world. You can be nearsighted. You can be farsighted. Or you can see 20/20. It depends. But you get to choose the lens that you are going to wear, those bifocals, you know.
What greater news?
Yeah,
for a human
that you
being.
Have the choice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, it's easy for me to talk about, well, you know, oppress people this, oppress people that. But one of my other greatest teachers is Thich Nhat Hanh, who was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, very active in protesting.
Oh, I think I read about that.
He's person. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
He was a mentor of Martin Luther King Jr. He was a huge anti-war activist during the Vietnam War era, but despised by both sides. And he was horribly, horribly oppressed throughout his life, just facing horrific circumstances. And throughout it, he's just like, I'm working to stop this messed up situation, but there's nothing you can do to me.
Right.
Like, you can't break how I look at the world.
Right.
Like, yeah, that's not up to you.
Right.
And he would do it in the most loving, kind way, and it's just like the ultimate defiance,
right?
And
yeah.
and really the ultimate empowerment,
right?
And I think the more people who realize that, like, the better off we're all going to be as a society.
I know I said that was the last question, but this brings up, how do you think we can get more people to understand that? Because it seems we talked about the strength that is required, such strength that is required to be able to adopt this mentality.
Right.
And that alone seems to be a barrier
right.
to get people to sort of have this raised state of consciousness. You talk about woke, right?
Right.
This is like on another level.
It is.
Right?
Yeah.
So do you have any tips to, I mean, you do this in your work, right? That's why you're here in New York. But but on a macro level, is there any way we could do it, or is it each one teach one?
You have to have the each one teach one. Like, it won't work without that.
Yeah.
But on a macro level, I think the more of us who are mindful of, like, our effect on the world around us, and, like, the more of us who are mindful about, are we stoking fears?
Right.
And it's something I struggle with daily. Like, I fully realize there are very acute, pressing problems that we face as a species right now, that our society faces, and you don't want to take them lightly, but at the same time, fear can make them a lot worse.
Right.
So we just got to be mindful about that fear. But what I think is that in Buddhism, there's something called authentic presence.
Okay.
And it's basically like when you are present for somebody else, and all of you is there, like, as we're talking, I'm not worried about what's happening tomorrow, and I'm not regretting what happened yesterday, and I'm all here for you.
Right.
You can sense that.
Right.
And I can sense when you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we're, as human beings, we're like instinctively attracted to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really important thing for teaching.
Okay.
Like when you're teaching anybody, you got to be all of you there for the people that you're exactly.
Yeah.
And when you set that example and you do it with joy and you do it with gratitude, people are going to be like, I need that.
Right.
How do I get some of that?
Right. And they'll be attracted to
right.
it.
Right. And they might just ask you that.
Yeah.
Now, our society already does this, but just on very superficial levels.
Okay.
Instagram is my favorite social media. And Instagram is just hopping with all these beautiful people who are, for whatever reason, there was some Kardashian Instagram came across a news story. It like 106 million people follow this.
Yeah, it's a
just
lot.
All like just like this really, I'm sure they're Kardashian, they're human beings like anybody else, but it's just like, we already live in a society where we look at people who have what we deem like wonderful lives and we want that.
Right.
I want to have my eyebrows done just like that. I want that dress. Right. I want that car. I want what they have.
Right.
So that's not a new thing for people. And we're already doing that. Like, what if we can change that to be like, I want that relationship with the world.
Mm.
I want to see the world like that person sees
it.
Right.
I want those glasses.
Exactly. Exactly.
That you chose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the glasses really for the lenses, not for the frames.
Right. Yeah. This metaphor is getting deep. Yes. It's funny because I wore glasses for a very long time. I wear contacts now. So
okay.
I definitely fully embrace the metaphor.
I can, These are the thin ones, and they're actually pretty thick.
Yeah.
But, it's easier to explain that way. And so I think that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
In our society. And honestly, I think a lot of people of influence are trying to work in that direction.
Sure.
But inertia is a thing.
Mm.
If we have a society that's really geared towards superficial bullshit, it's that has inertia. It's going to be hard to stop that motion.
Right.
It's hard to bring it to a stop and then redirect it in a different way.
Sure.
But I totally believe it can be done. I'm an optimist. I think that if we're not terrified of each other, there's nothing that human beings can't solve.
Mm.
And I believe that because I see it every day. I work in the most diverse circumstances, their most diverse groups, and we get stuff done.
Amazing. Arno Michaelis. Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Amazing.
Chloe Valdery?
Yes! Most people get it wrong on the first try. But yes, thank you so much for joining the Theory of Enchantment podcast. This conversation was awesome.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure, Chloe, and I really look forward to like delving more into Theory of Enchantment.
Amazing.
Let's wage some peace.
Let's do it.
All right.
It's time for this week's portion of Mad Theory of Enchantment Vibes. This week's portion comes from a conversation between Nikki Giovanni and James Baldwin. In this two-hour conversation, which is on YouTube, if you YouTube it and want to check it out for yourselves, there's a point where Nikki Giovanni says, and I quote, "Love is a tremendous responsibility." And James Baldwin responds by saying, "It is the only one to take. There isn't any other." What an incredible, incredible conclusion for two amazing human beings to come to amazing thinkers, poets, writers, authors to come to as they explored how to cultivate and deepen relationships between Black and white Americans in the 50s and 60s. And today's quote of the day, very similar to our Mad Theory of Enchantment Vibe segment, actually comes from James Baldwin, who was once engaged in a debate in the UK and famously said these words, quote, "I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other." That makes for this week's Theory of Enchantment podcast. I hope you enjoyed. I hope you learned so much from my interview with Arno Michaelis, and I hope you take what you learn and spread it to your communities, to your neighbors, to your schools, and everywhere. Spread love, spread light, and as always, thank you for listening.